Well, we certainly dealt with some extreme cold and a lot of snow this last winter. It's great to be putting that behind us. But that means that spring is coming, and that can mean severe weather to be aware of. We'll find out about that and a whole lot more as we visit with our weather guys. They always have a way of explaining complex topics in a way that not only I can understand, but I think they most anybody will be able to understand it as well, and they're happy to share it with others. Steve Ackerman directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. Steve, great to have you with us. Thanks so much.
It's great being here.
And coming up soon, John Martin, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. He's finishing up a class, but will be with us.
He's teaching. He loves to teach, as we all do. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here.
That's exactly right. And you can join in right now with your weather-related questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Post on my Facebook page. We've had, over the years, we've had some wonderful photos, weather-related photos that I've just always loved to see. And I hope if you have one or some, you'll post them up on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear that. You wrote an article for the Wisconsin State Journal about preparing for severe weather. Why are we so likely to have severe weather in spring?
Oh, that's a good question. To get severe weather, what you really need, and by severe weather, we're usually talking about really heavy lightning, large hail, like an inch or larger, winds greater than 75 miles per hour, or tornadoes.
Tornadoes.
And to get those types of severe thunderstorms, we need a couple of things. One is warm, moist air near the ground. And, of course, that really starts to happen in the springtime.
Yeah.
And the other thing is we want the air to increase in speed as we go from the ground upward and turn in direction so that the air up above is going, say, from the west, whereas the air down near the ground is coming from the south. And that adds rotation to the storm. And those conditions occur, start to really occur frequently around here in the May-June timeframe, springtime, as we...
I know that we've talked about how weather prediction in general has really improved over the last few years. Does that really apply to being able to predict the severe weather accurately?
What's getting really good is being able to narrow down the area where it's likely to occur. That's one thing that's improving. The other thing that's improving is getting a longer lead time. You know, so maybe we're up to maybe 3 or 4 days now where we'll be saying, look for hazardous severe weather in the upper Midwest in the next 3 to 4 days. And in the past, that would be really hard to do as well.
Okay, so we've gotten better.
We've gotten better, yeah.
And
so it's still hard to pinpoint where it's going to occur.
Yeah.
So we really kind of think of it as areas, and then that area is that target area, if you will, is getting smaller and smaller.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And really hard. I'm just thinking back. Now, this is 20 years ago. I saw a tornado, and the tornado was across a field quite a ways away from us, going in another direction. Didn't have anything to do with us.
That's good.
But certainly raised Cain with several other houses and farms that were in the area.
Yeah.
So to pinpoint...
To pinpoint where those are going to go.
You know, like just that right on the money's got to be darn near impossible.
I mean, the way we do it now is we don't necessarily forecast it, but we identify where they are using radars and then pinpoint where it is and track it and try and estimate or extrapolate where it might be going.
I remember being in the Minneapolis area when there was a tornado that right through the Minneapolis-St. Paul, and there was actually traffic guys following it.
Oh, right.
And reporting is now it's over here and it's going this way and it was quite exciting to listen to.
Yeah, if you have traffic people, you know, spread out and then observing it as it comes by, that's one thing. But usually not a good idea to follow tornadoes because they can radically change directions, right? Yeah, or another one may spawn down right next to it, which could also be a problem.
Oh man, we have callers online who want to visit with you. And Jerry and Serona, let's go to you. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. Regarding this past winter, with people running out of fuel and cities struggling with frozen pipes and stuff, could this happen again next winter?
It could. It definitely could. likelihood is going, I would say, is reduced for one reason in particular, and that is it looks like El Nino is developing, albeit a very weak one. And with El Nino weathers, usually we have warmer than normal winters, not colder than normal. So it would be possible, but I would say
like
unlikely.
It. Yeah.
Okay. Which is good because I'm tired of it.
Yeah. Well, then we might not have El Nino for years. How about the following years? You know, this new reality is what scares me.
Oh, yeah. Well, we had a winter like this back in the late 70s, 78, 79. Mm-hmm. So what was that, 30, 40 years ago?
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, I could wait another 30, 40 years before we had another cold winter like this.
Yeah. Hopefully it's not becoming something that's every other year.
That would certainly be the case. And if it turns out to be much more frequent than what it's been in the past, hopefully we'll be much better at forecasting it so that we can plan ahead, or the energy industries can plan ahead for where to make sure there's enough fuel to heat houses and stuff.
Thanks, Jerry. Pete in La Crosse. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry. Yeah, I'm concerned about the climate inside my house, especially as it varies towards cool places like near the windows. And I know you guys know about air properties. But I use a psychrometric calculator to predict the dew points. And this is important because we don't want to have reach a dew point in our house. My friends, including a contractor, have never heard of the psychrometric calculator and, in fact, have no idea how few degrees house air has to be cooled to reach a dew point. So I'm hoping, for the benefit of contractors and other people, that one of you can make a guest appearance on Larry's Home Improvement Show, or maybe this is a good time to teach the listeners and contractors about how a psychrometric calculator works, and maybe share some data points with us. I have one I want to share if I can get back on.
Yeah,
I don't. I'm not sure what a psychrometric calculator is. You know, so I take a temperature and a dew point temperature, or a temperature and a relative humidity temperature, and then we run that through a calculation. There is a theoretical thermodynamic equation that can allows you to convert between all those parameters. So that's where I come up with my dew point. And you're right, dew point's an important variable for interior of the house. You certainly don't want to be hitting the dew point unless you want to live in like a tropical botanical garden type of thing. And the wintertime, usually the dew point is really, really low, though. Although we're hitting the springtime now, so maybe it's going up in your house. But I would think it's really low unless you're humidifying the interior of your house.
You know, my concern is when it's generally nice in the middle of the house and then right up against the windows with the curtains providing a little bit of...
Right.
You know, it only takes 25 degrees change in temperature to get from room temperature down to 100% humidity to the dew point.
Right, yep. And then you have condensation,
and
condensation is bad for any kind of building material.
Especially for wooden window frames and things like that.
Yep.
But a lot of people think that temperature spread is much greater, but it's only 25 degrees to get down to the dew point.
Yeah, close to the windows.
Yep.
Right, yeah.
Or inside the walls, et cetera.
Right.
Maybe I'll talk about this next time on the Home Improvement Show, but it's a relatively simple online tool that people can make use of if they knew it was there.
So it's probably an app.
Maybe, yeah, like on a phone, an iPhone.
Or... Psychrometric calculator. We'll look it up and we'll find out some more about it. Thanks, Pete, for calling. I appreciate it. We had an email from Dawn in Madison. Can you explain what bombogenesis is? I have no idea.
I'm trying to think if there's a better way to pronounce it, and it's not coming to my mind. Maybe John will know. What it is these mid-latitude cyclonic storms, or, you know, cold front, warm fronts, mid-latitude cyclones. They all have a different name, but they're the same type of storm. As they go up the East Coast, where you have a good contrast between the warm, moist Gulf Stream waters and the colder land, the cyclone can rapidly intensify and develop into what's called a bomb. And where that phrase comes from, I don't know. But it probably has to do with the association of a very fast pressure drop in the system that allows it to spin up and get a very strong wintry system.
Okay, all right. Well, that makes sense. We had an email from a homeschooler in Hammond. March is usually the snowiest month, but I I don't think it was this year. What was the snowiest month? Is March really the snowiest month?
That's a question for John. I'm not sure that March is
that. John will be here in a minute or two.
Yeah, I mean, we can get some good snows in March. I don't really remember. We got a lot of little ones this past March, but I don't remember us getting any big storms this past March.
So you've got an event coming up, too, by the way, I wanted to mention.
Yeah, we do. The Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences is sponsoring the Len Robick Lecture. And it's usually about climate or areas about climate. And this year, on April 17th, we have Michael Mann coming. And he's a climatologist. And his recent claim to fame, I guess, would be the so-called hockey stick, that plot that shows you the rapid increase in temperature. And he'll be talking about how it got the name hockey stick and not just the science behind it, but also the interesting interactions he had with public and press about dealing with
and so
global
that's,
warming.
And so that's April 7th?
April 7th, 17th. April 17th at 7 o'clock in the microbial building.
On the UW campus.
On the UW campus, yeah.
I think we posted a link on my Facebook page.
Oh, good. Great. That'd
so
be great.
We've got that. Judith put that up. So
it's open to the public. He's a good speaker, and it'll entertain a lot of questions. So it should be a really fun event.
And John Martin joins us. Hi, John.
Hey, how you doing?
How do we is
bombogenesis? You know, when a cyclone, you know, off the East Coast develops into a bomb. Is it ever named? Is it called bombogenesis?
Yeah, people refer to it that way.
It just sounds funny.
Yeah, it does. nowadays, yeah. Right. But, people use that word.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the IdeasNet, and then we'll be back with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, for answering more of your questions. Stay with us. There is never a shortage of things to talk about with the weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Tell us what we've been experiencing weather-wise, what's on the horizon, and, of course, they make us a whole lot smarter in general. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. John Martin, Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John, great to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
And Steve Ackerman, Director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies and also a professor. Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Well, we have, and there's always lots of things to talk about. We were talking about snowmelt a little bit, and Gary in Wausau has a comment that relates to that. So let's go there. Gary, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I was wondering about the snowmelt and what your feelings are on it. As with the depth of frost in some areas up here, it's 6-7 feet. Some of our mains have been freezing, some of our water lines in our towns and everything else. We've been on a keep drip type of situation. But some of the frost is only down, a couple, maybe three feet. So what are your opinions on that, of what the flood situation is going to be? I'm tuck pointing. I live in a 100-year-old farmhouse, and I'm tuck pointing my masonry foundation right now.
It's easy to forget that there's water in the ground too that you got to worry about, and you're taking good precaution there. One of the things though that I've been commenting on to a lot of people this last few weeks, at least in the southern part of the state, is that how gradual the snow melt's been. We had, of course, a cold winter and little amounts of snow on quite a number of days, and so it piled up to a lot. By the time the winter was really pretty much over, it was a lot of snow to get rid of, but there was never any big rain event that kind of made it floody or the ground. Even now, it's just taken this melt so slowly and gradually, but persistently, that it's in pretty good shape down here in the southern part of the state. I can't testify to the frost depth, but I know that's probably a more significant issue this year than it's been in the recent past, because this was such a cold winter. But I don't know, Steve, heard anything about that?
I had heard that the National Weather Service, the hydrology part of that, was talking about, giving a heads up for stream potential flooding, probably because of the frozen ground.
Yeah, it just runs off like cement.
But, we were just talking during break. I'd been out of town for 5 days, and when I landed, it's just like the snow's gone. And it's not flooding, and it's not sitting anywhere. There must be just enough warmth that the water and the snow that melted is just sitting inside the soil and not.
Along these lines, something else that I noticed on the weekend, because it was a nice day to take a walk around the lake, all of them, the major lakes, and I'd say all of them in Madison, even the smallest ones, still have whitish, not dark ice on them. You know, that ice is going to be there a few more days. Cloudy day today. It's going to be a pretty chilly, cloudy week this week. We're going to be into the second week of April before we have a chance to see any substantial breakup. And I was at Picnic Point all the way from there to Governor's Island, which is the standard measure on Lake Mendota. There's not a bit of gray in that ice. It's all white. So it's pretty solid.
Yeah, there you go. Gary, thanks. Appreciate the call. Willem in Colfax, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. There was an article published in last Sunday's Leader Telegram. I think it was from the McClatchy Tribune, and it was by a professor, John R. Christie, who is a professor of atmospheric science at the University of Alabama in Huntsville.
Wow.
His contention is that the reason that we argue about climate change is that the climate change science, he says, we basically cannot prove anything about how the climate will change as a result of adding extra greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. He's saying that all these computer models are just speculation, and that there's been no change in hurricanes or tornadoes over the last 120 years, and that droughts are not as bad as they were 1,000 years ago. So I was wondering if you have heard of this gentleman and what your opinion was of his.
All right.
Yeah, I've met him. He hosted me for a visit down there, he and his colleague at Huntsville some years ago, I guess 3 or 4 years ago. He's a very nice guy, but he's definitely a global warming science skeptic. And yet when you get in a conversation with him, this is exactly the kind of things that he starts to say. On the one hand, they'll say the models are no good at predicting how the atmosphere will change when there's more greenhouse gases. And then on the other hand, he'll say something along the lines of what you just said. Droughts are not as bad as they were 1,000 years ago. Well, how do you know that? You don't know that except by using numerical models. So you can't play with the same tools that you prohibit other people from using and come to conclusion with them. So it's a little bit shady. Like I said, he's a nice guy, and he's no dummy. He's a very smart guy. He has a strong set of opinions, and those opinions, I'm afraid, are on the outside of the consensus. And I think there's a reason for that. I think he's on the wrong track on some of those things.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Willem, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. We're talking a little about severe weather, but other weather as well. If you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Speaking of Facebook page, Phil sent us something. And it says, "Hi, Larry. The weather guys answered a question for Tom Skilling of WGN-TV Chicago about the mirror effect of individual snowflakes causing snow twinkle. And he's got a photo. He said, here's a flake doing its job. What do you think?"
That's a very interesting shot. It's zoomed up of a snow on the ground, and there's one ice crystal that's orientated in just the right way, and it's like the sun is in there. It's like a little mini sun is being reflected off of there. It's a really bright sparkle. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I don't know that we ever talked about snow twinkles before on the show.
Yeah, when ice crystals, you know, develop on the snow field, they can just lay flat or, you know, slightly tilted. And if you ever look at a snow field and it's got a sparkliness to it, each one of those sparkles is an individual ice crystal that as the sun's rays hit it, it just reflects it like a mirror.
Yeah.
And it reflects it to the eye. And as you move, you're seeing different ice crystals. And so it gets to sparkle. And if you look closely, sometimes you'll even see color in them because the refraction and the reflections of the light separate the colors sometimes. It's really
very cool.
So cold weather I've been complaining about, but it's actually beautiful. Right? So we're going to miss it come August.
You're finally speaking my gospel.
Daniel sent us a funny funny photo of, "This is what our fishing opener could look like."
I'm telling you, the ice on the lakes, even in the southern part of the state, looks pretty solid for April 1st.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, man. And he said he heard Russia is having its warmest spring on record.
Yeah, not surprising. I'm sure that's right. Yeah, that's right.
And why is that not surprising?
Well, I'll only say not surprising because I've been keeping track of this every winter for the last several years. And we had a bitterly cold winter here, but the overall hemispheric measure, one measure of the overall hemispheric depth of the winter was that it was the warmest winter since at least 1948-49. And the two places that were particularly warm were Western Europe for a time and then Central Europe, Russia.
Oh, so, okay. Mm. Well, there we go. Jeff in Madison, it is your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, gentlemen. I just returned from a trip to Central America. We were in Costa Rica and just wanted, being a weather enthusiast, of course, you open your eyes, you look around and you try to observe. And it was, I had never been in the intertropical zone before. It's very close to the Tropic of Cancer where we were. And I just noticed a couple of things. I think that the daylight, the number of hours of daylight seemed a little bit less than what we have here, at least right now. I also noticed that I watched, and I wasn't surprised that you watch the convective growth of clouds and precipitation in the afternoon, and you start a day where you don't see any of it. And I had expected that. But I think the most interesting thing about Costa Rica and where I was the absence of any type of insects like we would have, you know, in July, August, September, around here, maybe even in June, when we get the warming and we get the insect hatch and we get the mosquitoes, I know this isn't directly weather related, but I noted that we hardly had any down there, and I was expecting the worst. So those are my observations from there. Otherwise, we were in the dry season there, and I was surprised when we were driving in the country how dry it is in the center of the country, and yet it's still in the southwestern part in the Pacific, quite you know, jungle-like and very humid. So just wanted to get your observations on that. You could definitely tell you were not in North America.
Yeah.
I was wondering if it was dry, maybe the bugs weren't hatching yet.
Yeah, right. Get that even here.
But even in the wet areas.
Even in the wet areas.
We were in the rainforest, and there wasn't a lot there. It's probably just an observation for me. But the only other thing I would say is now I'll switch to North America. Anything goes this summer, gentlemen. I mean, from what we just had and what you commented about that we were bitter cold, I, too, was following some of the other parts of the world. So I just think that the arrow was pointed straight at us, and it really didn't move. So that's my thought.
Mm. Yeah,
it's definitely true. Cool. I think the summer will be warmer than this past winter, though. I can say that with confidence.
Even with a climate model, I'll tell you that.
Right, that's right. But we don't, all joking aside, some people have asked us maybe in a related way, you know, does the depth of the cold winter really kind of harbinger for a warmer than average summer? And there's not much signal there, apparently, or certainly not for a warmer than average spring. Mm. So we don't know, but not a colder than average spring either.
There you go. You're talking about bugs. Just reminded me. This is a kind of an aside, but we've been to Disney 25 times in Orlando.
That's right.
I have yet to be bitten by a mosquito.
Really? Wow.
I have yet. You never see bugs. I don't know where they go or how they go
to Minnesota. In
Alaska.
Well, didn't Phil Pelletieri say there's 22 different species that hatch in the course of a summer and in the spring here? 22, and they're doing
22
serial
different
fashion.
Geez.
Oh, my God, it's an onslaught here.
Jeff and Marcus Ann, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just have a basic question. If the world, let's assume that the world is billions and billions of years old, and certainly we see that there's been ice ages and different types of things like that. My question would be, is how do we know what average is? And if our computer models are comparing against average, that might only, in your previous example, only 60 years old, 70 years old, as far as 1948 was concerned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yep. And so what we do is we define it. And the typical way we define it now is a 30-year period. And the current 30-year period ends in 2010, right? And goes back. And every 30 years that changes. So in 2020, we'll shift it all up another 30 years. And we average those temperatures together, and that's what we call the normal conditions. And we probably put paraphrases around those because everything in some regards is relative. And so
But on the other hand, that's in the short term. We definitely have to keep a sliding scale on that. But in the very long term, we have tools at our disposal to figure out how things were 500,000 or 600,000 years ago, or sometimes even longer ago than that. They don't involve a great deal of approximation. They involve some measurement error and so on, but they're really good proxies. You take air bubbles out of ice cores that have been preserved for hundreds of thousands of years at high latitude, particularly in the southern hemisphere, and you can tell a lot about the atmospheric composition, and then we know about at those times, and then we know how the physical interaction of those chemicals in the atmosphere works with solar and terrestrial radiation, and we can recreate those things pretty well. So there's not as much guesswork as some people seem to think there is. On the other hand, there's nowhere near as much certainty as certain people will sometimes discuss either. So there's some gray, but it's not very much.
Yeah.
There you go.
I have another question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, so what happened then to end the Ice Age?
An excellent question. Certainly a question of... whether vegetation starts to show up in places it wasn't before. You look at a satellite picture, for instance, today of Minnesota, southern Canada. It doesn't look like there's snow on the ground there, but there certainly is. What you're seeing is the pine trees sticking through it. So there's changes in vegetation across the globe over these kinds of timescales that will actually either work in favor of prolonging an ice age or actually work in favor of beginning to erode it. Ocean circulations change over thousands of year timescales and so on. The Earth's orbit changes over hundreds and thousands of years timescales. So there's a lot of different physical factors that can go into that. And when they all play pointing in the same direction is probably when you have the big changes from either an ice-covered Earth to one that is less ice-covered. Yeah. It's a very interesting question, though.
What was the length of time then from the beginning of the Ice Age, and how did that occur, to the end of the Ice Age when climate normalized, whatever normal is?
Yeah. I think there's about 150,000 year cycle or something, and it has to do with the obliquity of the Earth's orbit. That's probably one of the primary ice age, non-ice age determinants. One of the interesting things about our current age on the planet, the last 10,000 or so years, is that the climate has been very stable in terms of big perturbations as far as we can reconstruct it. An unusually long period of time without major changes of the kind that we sometimes have seen in periods much shorter than 10,000 years in the long historical record. So that's a question, too. How has that been the case? We don't really know the answer to that.
No. Thanks, Jeff, for calling. Appreciate it. Stefan in Madison, your turn. Hi, Steph.
Hello. Yes.
What's on your mind?
Well, two things. One of them is I want to report here looking out from my window over Lake Mendota. Completely solid ice frozen. Yesterday, I had a nice walk around in Middleton, Sticker Pond, and Tiedemann's Pond, and they are completely frozen. And that's the situation. I can just contribute to the observations. Yeah. And then a question, if the colleague could say something about the Wisconsin cryosphere in the age of global warming.
All right.
Yeah, very interesting. Stefan, good to hear from you. Stefan Hastenrath is an emeritus professor in our department, one of the world's experts in tropical meteorology. And he and I often talk about the catastrophe of ice forming on the big lakes here, how fast it happens. So he has an eye on the ice all the time. I think in the last, 160 years or something, Lake Mendota, the ice, the length of time the ice has been on has gone down by 18 days over that period of time on average.
Yeah.
And then there are years like this one, I think, will be an anomaly in the long sense.
But beyond the median,
There's bounces up and down, but the long-term average has decreased by 18 days, which is about 20% of the average season. So the ice season has decreased by about 20% in the last 150 years here.
Wow.
That's 2 weeks. Yeah, less ice fishing.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Three if you're cautious.
Well, or not cautious.
Yeah, back in the days when I was a young guy and you know how the ice always melts right near the shore. We take a plank and put it out onto the ice and out on the plank to get out on the ice there for that last bit of fishing.
That gives walking the plank a whole new meaning.
Oh, my goodness. Stefan, thanks.
Well, don't forget, tomorrow we celebrate April Fool's Day. Mm-hmm. And I think our Wisconsin cryosphere does a very, very nice contribution.
That's for sure.
I suppose you don't want to divulge that. April Fool's Day.
No, we're fools enough. Yeah, right.
There was, I was thinking back to my April Fool. When I was a young guy and I was looking, I was in league for, in competition for a position, and I got a note from the secretary that I'd gotten a call from this company or from this organization. It was the Department of Ag, Trade and Consumer Protection, from Dr. Lyon. And I called several times and got a busy signal all day long. I kept trying. And I find out at the end of the day that it was the Vilas Park Zoo.
Oh, man.
And Dr. Lyon. I finally got through at 5:30 in the afternoon, and the guy at the zoo said, "Oh, no, this is the zoo."
Oh,
he said,
all day long.
He said, "We take the phone off the hook on New Year's." On April Fool's Day, we take the phone off the hook because there's so many calls for Mr. Bear or Mr. Lion.
That's terrible.
Yeah. I was so mad at the secretary who pulled that on me. I didn't get that job, so here I am. Emily in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Emily.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is regarding the use of tornado sirens or warning sirens.
Yeah.
I didn't know if there's like a statewide or even nationwide standard for when they should be triggered. I lived for most of my life under the assumption that they were only triggered for tornado warnings in your area. And then I moved to a city in northern Wisconsin, and the first time I heard the tornado siren, I wasn't aware of there actually being a tornado warning, and come to find out they triggered them for watches, for warnings. So I found it really confusing. And I didn't know if it was up to each city and town when they could be triggered or if there was an actual standard or law in the state.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I would guess there's two things that possibly are going on. So let me just make a guess that there is a national standard, but that I think some of the criteria and decision-making in the process of alerting the public has probably changed. So maybe there was a change that was coincident with your moving to a new place. That's just a guess. I don't know. It certainly would be wise if it were sort of a national standard in those areas that face the threat of tornadoes. But I don't know the answer. Good question.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that it is a nationally regulated on who can do it and who cannot do it. And I'm pretty sure it has to be associated with the National Weather Service, maybe the National Severe Storm Labs set it off. I don't think they do it for watches. I think it's only done for warnings.
Yeah.
But we'll have to look into it. And it's done for a region. So, you know, it could be, the siren could be going off and it could look like there's no thunderstorms in your area, but in the locale for that section of the tornadoes, it may be...
There might be something there.
Or it could be testing. I know down here they test them every first Wednesday of the month at noon.
First Wednesday, There's one right outside our studio.
It is possible that they might sound them for a thunderstorm warning in addition to tornado warning.
If they... That would seem sort of rogue to me.
Yeah.
I don't think so. But, you know, maybe somebody's got their finger on the button and they're doing that. I hope that's not the case.
Yeah,
but
I think it would be just for tornado warnings.
Yeah, I'd be suspicious if that were true.
Thanks, Emily. Thank you for calling. We have a severe weather spotters class is going to be held in Dane County on April 22nd.
They would know.
At the Alliant Energy Center. So, well, we have a link on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show to some more information about that if you want to sign up for a severe weather spotter class, April 22nd in Dane County at the Alliant Energy Center. Hey, boy, the time flew. John, Steve, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Larry.
We'll look forward to your visit at the end of April. Oh, my goodness.
Mayflower's on the way.
Mayflower's on the way. Oh, man. We thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. Well, we certainly dealt with some extreme cold and a lot of snow this last winter. It's great to be putting that behind us, but that means that spring is coming, and that can mean severe weather to be aware of. We'll find out about that and a whole lot more as we visit with our weather guys. They always have a way of explaining complex topics in a way that not only I can understand, but I think they most anybody will be able to understand it as well, and they're happy to share it with others. Steve Ackerman directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. Steve, great to have you with us. Thanks so much.
It's great being here.
And coming up soon, John Martin, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. He's finishing up a class, but will be with us.
He's teaching. He loves to teach, as we all do. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here.
That's exactly right. And you can join in right now with your weather-related questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Post on my Facebook page. We've had, over the years, we've had some wonderful photos, weather-related photos that I've just always loved to see. And I hope if you have one or some, you'll post them up on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear that. You wrote an article for the Wisconsin State Journal about preparing for severe weather. Why are we so likely to have severe weather in spring?
Oh, that's a good question. To get severe weather, what you really need, and by severe weather, we're usually talking about really heavy lightning, large hail, like an inch or larger, winds greater than 75 miles per hour, or tornadoes. And to get those types of severe thunderstorms, we need a couple of things. One is warm, moist air near the ground. And, of course, that really starts to happen in the springtime.
Yeah.
And the other thing is we want the air to increase in speed as we go from the ground upward and turn in direction so that the air up above is going, say, from the west, whereas the air down near the ground is coming from the south. And that adds rotation to the storm. And those conditions occur, start to really occur frequently around here in the May-June timeframe, springtime as we...
I know that we've talked about how weather prediction in general has really improved over the last few years. Does that really apply to being able to predict the severe weather accurately?
What's getting really good is being able to narrow down the area where it's likely to occur. That's one thing that's improving. The other thing that's improving is getting a longer lead time. You know, so maybe we're up to maybe 3 or 4 days now where we'll be saying, look for hazardous severe weather in the upper Midwest in the next 3 to 4 days. And in the past, that would be really hard to do as well.
Okay, so we've gotten better.
We've gotten better,
And so
it's still hard to pinpoint where it's going to occur.
Yeah.
So we really kind of think of it as areas, and then that area is that target area, if you will, is getting smaller and smaller.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And really hard. I'm just thinking back. Now, this is 20 years ago. I saw a tornado, and the tornado was across a field quite a ways away from us, going in another direction. Didn't have anything to do with us.
That's good.
But certainly raised Cain with several other houses and farms that were in the area.
Yeah.
So to pinpoint
where those are going to go.
You know, that right on the money has got to be darn near impossible.
I mean, the way we do it now is we don't necessarily forecast it, but we identify where they are using radars and then pinpoint where it is and track it and try and estimate or extrapolate where it might be going.
I remember being in the Minneapolis area when there was a tornado that right through the Minneapolis-St. Paul, and there was actually traffic guys following it.
Oh, right.
And reporting is now it's over here and it's going this way, and it was quite exciting to listen to.
Yeah, if you have traffic people, you know, spread out and then observing it as it comes by, that's one thing. But usually not a good idea to follow tornadoes because they can radically change directions. Right? Yeah, or another one may spawn down right next to it, which could also be a problem.
Oh man, we have callers online who want to visit with you. And Jerry and Serona, let's go to you. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. Regarding this past winter, with people running out of fuel and cities struggling with frozen pipes and stuff, could this happen again next winter?
It could. It definitely could. Likelihood is going, I would say, is reduced for one reason in particular, and that is it looks like El Nino is developing, albeit a very weak one. And with El Nino weathers, usually we have warmer than normal winters, not colder than normal. So it would be possible, but I would say
like
unlikely.
It.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Which is good because I'm tired of it.
Yeah. Well, then we might not have El Nino for years. How about the following years? You know, this new reality is what scares me.
Oh, yeah. Well, we had a winter like this back in the late 70s, 78, 79. Mm-hmm. So what was that, 30, 40 years ago?
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, I could wait another 30, 40 years before we had another cold winter like this.
Yeah. Hopefully it's not becoming something that's every other year.
That would certainly be the case. And if it turns out to be much more frequent than what it's been in the past, hopefully we'll be much better at forecasting it so that we can plan ahead, or the energy industries can plan ahead for where to make sure there's enough fuel to heat houses and stuff.
Thanks, Jerry. Pete in La Crosse. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry. Yeah, I'm concerned about the climate inside my house, especially as it varies towards cool places like near the windows. And I know you guys know about air properties, but I use a psychrometric calculator to predict the dew points. And this is important because we don't want to have reach the dew point in our house. My friends, including a contractor, have never heard of the psychrometric calculator and, in fact, have no idea how few degrees house air has to be cooled to reach the dew point. So I'm hoping, for the benefit of contractors and other people, that one of you can make a guest appearance on Larry's Home Improvement Show, or maybe this is a good time to teach the listeners and contractors about how a psychrometric calculator works, and maybe share some data points with us. I have one I want to share if I can get back on.
Yeah.
I don't. I'm not sure what a psychrometric calculator is. You know, so I take a temperature and a dew point temperature, or a temperature and a relative humidity temperature, and then we run that through a calculation. There is a theoretical thermodynamic equation that can allows you to convert between all those parameters. So that's where I come up with my dew point. And you're right, dew point's an important variable for interior of the house. You certainly don't want to be hitting the dew point unless you want to live in like a tropical botanical garden type of thing. And the wintertime, usually the dew point is really, really low, though. Although we're hitting the springtime now, so maybe it's going up in your house. But I would think it's really low unless you're humidifying the interior of your house.
No, my concern is when it's generally nice in the middle of the house and then right up against the windows with the curtains providing a little bit of...
Right.
You know, it only takes 25 degrees change in temperature to get from room temperature down to 100% humidity to the dew point.
Right, yep. And then you have condensation,
and
condensation is bad for any kind of building material.
Especially for wooden window frames and things like that.
Yep.
But a lot of people think that temperature spread is much greater, but it's only 25 degrees to get down to the dew point.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, close to the windows.
Yep.
Right.
Right, yeah.
Or inside the walls,
yep,
et cetera.
Right.
Maybe I'll talk about this next time on the Home Improvement Show, but it's a relatively simple online tool that people can make use of if they knew it was there.
So it's probably an app.
Oh, maybe, yeah, like on a phone, an iPhone.
Or... Psychrometric calculator. We'll look it up and we'll find out some more about it. Thanks, Pete, for calling. I appreciate it. We had an email from Dawn in Madison. Can you explain what bombogenesis is?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
I'm trying to think if there's a better way to pronounce it, and it's not coming to my mind. Maybe John will know. What it is these mid-latitude cyclonic storms, or, you know, cold front, warm fronts, mid-latitude cyclones. They all have a different name, but they're the same type of storm. As they go up the East Coast, where you have a good contrast between the warm, moist Gulf Stream waters and the colder land, the cyclone can rapidly intensify and develop into what's called a bomb. And where that phrase comes from, I don't know. But it probably has to do with the association of a very fast pressure drop in the system that allows it to spin up and get a very strong wintry system.
Okay, all right. Well, that makes sense. We had an email from a homeschooler in Hammond. March is usually the snowiest month, but I don't think it was this year. What was the snowiest month? Is March really the snowiest month?
That's a question for John. I'm not sure that March is.
John will be here in a minute or two.
Yeah, I mean, we can get some good snows. in March. I don't really remember. We got a lot of little ones this past March, but I don't remember us getting any big storms this past March.
So you've got an event coming up, too, by the way, I wanted to mention.
Yeah, we do. The Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences is sponsoring the Len Robick Lecture. And it's usually about climate or areas about climate. And this year, on April 17th, we have Michael Mann coming. And he's a climatologist. And his recent claim to fame, I guess, would be the so-called hockey stick, that plot that shows you the rapid increase in temperature. And it's he'll be talking about how it got the name hockey stick and not just the science behind it, but also the interesting interactions he had with publics and press about dealing with
and so
the global warming.
And so that's April 7th?
April 7th, 17th. April 17th at 7 o'clock in the Microbial Building.
On the UW campus.
On the UW campus, yeah.
I think we posted a link on my Facebook page.
Oh, good, great. That'd
so
be great.
We've got that. Judith put that up. So
it's open to the public. He's a good speaker, and it'll entertain a lot of questions. So it should be a really fun event.
And John Martin joins us. Hi, John.
Hey, how you doing?
How do we print? Is
bombogenesis? We know when a cyclone, off the East Coast develops into a bomb. Does it ever name? Is it called bombogenesis?
Yeah, people refer to it that way.
It just sounds funny.
Yeah, it does. nowadays, yeah. Right. People use that word.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, for answering more of your questions. Stay with us. There is never a shortage of things to talk about with the weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Tell us what we've been experiencing weather-wise, what's on the horizon, and of course they make us a whole lot smarter in general. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. John Martin, Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John, great to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
And Steve Ackerman, Director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies and also a professor. Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Well, we have, and there's always lots of things to talk about. We were talking about snowmelt a little bit, and Gary in Wausau has a comment that relates to that. So let's go there. Gary, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I was wondering about the snowmelt and what your feelings are on it. As with the depth of frost in some areas up here, it's 6-7 feet. Some of our mains have been freezing, some of our water lines in our towns and everything else. We've been on a keep drip type of situation. But some of the frost is only down, a couple, maybe three feet. So what are your opinions on that, of what the flood situation is going to be? I'm tuck pointing. I live in a 100-year-old farmhouse, and I'm tuck pointing my masonry foundation right now, just in case.
Yeah.
It's easy to forget that there's water in the ground too that you got to worry about, and you're taking good precaution there. One of the things though that I've been commenting on to a lot of people this last few weeks, at least in the southern part of the state, is that how gradual the snow melt's been. We had, of course, a cold winter and little amounts of snow on quite a number of days, and so it piled up to a lot. By the time the winter was really pretty much over, it was a lot of snow to get rid of, but there was never any big rain event that kind of made it floody or the ground. Even now, it's just taken this melt so slowly and gradually, but persistently, that it's in pretty good shape down here in the southern part of the state. I can't testify to the frost depth, but I know that's probably a more significant issue this year than it's been in the recent past, because this was such a cold winter. But I don't know, Steve, any heard anything about that?
I had heard that the National Weather Service, the hydrology part of that, was talking about, giving a heads up for stream potential flooding, probably because of the frozen ground.
Yeah, it just runs off like cement.
But, we were just talking during break. I'd been out of town for 5 days, and when I landed, it's just like the snow's gone. And it's not flooding, and it's not sitting anywhere. It's so there must be just enough warmth that the water and the snow that melted is just sitting inside the soil.
Along these lines, something else that I noticed on the weekend, because it was a nice day to take a walk around the lake, all of the major lakes, and I'd say all of them in Madison, even the smallest ones, still have whitish, not dark ice on them. That ice is going to be there a few more days. Cloudy day today. It's going to be a pretty chilly, cloudy week this week. we're going to be into the second week of April before we have a chance to see any substantial breakup. And I was at Picnic Point all the way from there to Governor's Island, which is the standard measure on Lake Mendota. There's not a bit of gray in that ice. It's all white. So it's pretty solid.
Yeah, there you go. Gary, thanks. Appreciate the call. Willem and Colfax, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. There was an article published in last Sunday's Leader Telegram. I think it was from the McClatchy Tribune, and it was by a professor, John R. Christie, who is a professor of atmospheric science at the University of Alabama in Huntsville.
Wow.
His contention is that the reason that we argue about climate change is that the climate change science, he says, we basically cannot prove anything about how the climate will change as a result of adding extra greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. He's saying that all these computer models are just speculation, and that there's been no change in hurricanes or tornadoes over the last 120 years, and that droughts are not as bad as they were 1,000 years ago. So I was wondering if you have heard of this gentleman and what your opinion was of his.
All right.
Yeah, I've met him. He hosted me for a visit down there, he and his colleague, at Huntsville some years ago, I guess 3 or 4 years ago. He's a very nice guy, but he's definitely a global warming science skeptic. And yet when you get in a conversation with him, this is exactly the kind of things that he starts to say. On the one hand, they'll say the models are no good at predicting how the atmosphere will change when there's more greenhouse gases. And then on the other hand, he'll say something along the lines of what you just said. Droughts are not as bad as they were 1,000 years ago. Well, how do you know that? You don't know that except by using numerical models. So you can't play with the same tools that you prohibit other people from using and come to conclusion with them. So it's a little bit shady. Like I said, he's a nice guy, and he's no dummy. He's a very smart guy. He has a strong set of opinions, and those opinions, I'm afraid, are on the outside of the consensus. And I think there's a reason for that. I think he's on the wrong track on some of those things.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Willem, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Talking a little about severe weather, but other weather as well. If you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Speaking of Facebook page, Phil sent us something. And it says, "Hi, Larry. The weather guys answered a question for Tom Skilling of WGN-TV Chicago about the mirror effect of individual snowflakes causing snow twinkle." And he's got a photo. He said, "Here's a flake doing its job." What do you think?
That's a very interesting shot. It's zoomed up of a snow on the ground, and there's one ice crystal that's orientated in just the right way, and it's like the sun is in there. It's like a little mini sun is being reflected off of there. It's a really bright sparkle. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I don't know that we ever talked about snow twinkles before on the show.
Yeah, when ice crystals, develop on the snow field, they can just lay flat or, slightly tilted. And if you ever look at a snow field and it's got a sparkliness to it, each one of those sparkles is an individual ice crystal that, as the sun's rays hit it, it just reflects it like a mirror.
Yeah.
And it reflects it to the eye. And as you move, you're seeing different ice crystals. And so it gets to sparkle. And if you look closely, sometimes you'll even see color in them because the refraction and the reflections of the light separate the colors sometimes. It's really
cool. Very cool.
So cold weather, I've been complaining about, but it's actually beautiful. We're going to miss it come August.
You're finally speaking my gospel.
Daniel sent us a funny photo of, "This is what our fishing opener could look like."
I'm telling you, the ice on the lakes, even in the southern part of the state, looks pretty solid for April 1st.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, man. And he said he heard Russia is having its warmest spring on record.
Yeah, not surprising. I'm sure that's right. Yeah, that's right.
And why is that not surprising?
Well, I'll only say not surprising because I've been keeping track of this every winter for the last several years. We had a bitterly cold winter here, but the overall hemispheric measure, one measure of the overall hemispheric depth of the winter, was that it was the warmest winter since at least 1948-49. And the two places that were particularly warm were Western Europe for a time and then Central Europe, Russia.
Oh,
so,
okay. Well, there we go. Jeff in Madison, it is your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, gentlemen. I just returned from a trip to Central America. We were in Costa Rica, and just wanted, being a weather enthusiast, of course, you open your eyes, you look around, and you try to observe. And it was, I had never been in the intertropical zone before. It's very close to the Tropic of Cancer where we were. And I just noticed a couple of things. I think that the number of hours of daylight seemed a little bit less than what we have here, at least right now. I also noticed that I watched, and I wasn't surprised that you watch the convective growth of clouds and precipitation in the afternoon, and you start a day where you don't see any of it. And I had expected that. But I think the most interesting thing about Costa Rica and where I was the absence of any type of insects like we would have, you know, in July, August, September, around here, maybe even in June. Some, when we get the warming and we get the insect catch and we get the mosquitoes, I know this isn't directly weather related, but I noted that we hardly had any down there, and I was expecting the worst. So those are my observations from there. Otherwise, we were in the dry season there, and I was surprised when we were driving in the country how dry it is in the center of the country, and yet it's still in the southwestern part in the Pacific, quite you know, jungle-like and very humid. So just wanted to get your observations on that. You could definitely tell you were not in North America.
Yeah.
I was wondering if it was dry, maybe the bugs weren't hatching yet.
Yeah, right. Get that even here.
But even in the wet areas. We were in the rainforest, and there wasn't a lot there. It's probably just an observation for me. But the only other thing I would say is now I'll switch to North America. Is anything goes this summer, gentlemen. I mean, from what we just had and what you commented about, that we were bitter cold, I, too, was following some of the other parts of the world. So I just think that the arrow was pointed straight at us, and it really didn't move. So that's my thought.
Mm. Yeah,
it's definitely true. Cool. I think the summer will be warmer than this past winter, though. I can say that with confidence. Yeah.
Even with a climate model, I'll tell you that.
Right, that's right. But we don't, all joking aside, some people have asked us, maybe in a related way, you know, does the depth of the cold winter really kind of harbinger for a warmer than average summer? And there's not much signal there, apparently. Or certainly not for a warmer than average spring. Mm. So we don't know. But not a colder than average spring either. So
there you go. I'm you're talking about bugs, just reminded me, this is a kind of an aside, but we've been to Disney 25 times in Orlando.
That's right.
I have yet to be bitten by a mosquito.
Really? Wow. Huh.
I have yet. You never see bugs. I don't know where they go or how
they go to Minnesota.
In Alaska.
Well, didn't Phil Pelletieri say there's 22 different species that hatch in the course of a summer and in the spring here? 22, and they're doing serial
different
fashion.
Geez.
God, it's an onslaught here.
Jeff and Marcus Ann, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just have a basic question. If the world, let's assume that the world is billions and billions of years old, and certainly we see that there's been ice ages and different types of things like that. My question would be, is how do we know what average is? And if our computer models are comparing against average, that might only, in your previous example, only 60 years old, 70 years old, as far as 1948 was concerned.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yep. And so what we do is we define it. And the typical way we define it now is a 30-year period. And the current 30-year period ends in 2010, right? And goes back.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So, yeah. And every 30 years that changes. So, in 2020, we'll shift it all up another 30 years.
Yeah.
And we average those temperatures together, and that's what we call the normal conditions. And we probably put paraphrases around those because, yeah, everything in some regards is relative, and so
marker. That's in the short term. We definitely have to keep a sliding scale on that. But in the very long term, we have tools at our disposal to figure out how things were 500,000 or 600,000 years ago, or sometimes even longer ago than that. They don't involve a great deal of approximation. They involve some measurement error and so on, but they're really good proxies. You take air bubbles out of ice cores that have been preserved for hundreds of thousands of years at high latitude, particularly in the southern hemisphere, And you can tell a lot about the atmospheric composition, and then we know about the at those times, and then we know how the physical interaction of those chemicals in the atmosphere works with solar and terrestrial radiation, and we can recreate those things pretty well. So there's not as much guesswork as some people seem to think there is. On the other hand, there's nowhere near as much certainty as certain people will sometimes discuss either. So there's some gray, but it's not very much.
Yeah.
There you go.
I have another question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, so what happened then to end the Ice Age?
An excellent question. Certainly a question of whether vegetation starts to show up in places it wasn't before. You look at a satellite picture, for instance, today of Minnesota, southern Canada. It doesn't look like there's snow on the ground there, but there certainly is. What you're seeing is the pine trees sticking through it. So there's changes in vegetation across the globe over these kinds of timescales that will actually either work in favor of prolonging an ice age or actually work in favor of beginning to erode it. Ocean circulations change over thousands of year timescales and so on. The Earth's orbit changes over hundreds and thousands of years timescales. So there's a lot of different physical factors that can go into that. And when they all play pointing in the same direction is probably when you have the big changes from either an ice-covered Earth to one that is less ice-covered.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting question, though.
Yeah.
What was the length of time then from the beginning of the Ice Age, and how did that occur, to the end of the Ice Age when climate normalized whatever normal is?
Yeah. I think there's about 150,000 year cycle or something, and it has to do with the obliquity of the Earth's orbit. That's probably one of the primary Ice Age, non-Ice Age determinants. One of the interesting things about our current age on the planet, the last 10,000 or so years, is that the climate has been very stable in terms of big perturbations, as far as we can reconstruct it, an unusually long period of time without major changes of the kind that we sometimes have seen in periods much shorter than 10,000 years in the long historical record. So that's a question, too. How has that been the case? We don't really know the answer to that.
No. Thanks, Jeff, for calling. Appreciate it. Stefan in Madison, your turn. Hi, Steph.
Hello. Yes.
What's on your mind?
Well, two things. One of them is I want to report here looking out from my window over Lake Mendota, completely solid ice frozen. Yesterday I had a nice walk around in Middleton, Sticker Pond and Tiedemann's Pond, and they are completely frozen. And that's the situation. I can just contribute to the observations.
Mm-hmm.
And then a question, if the colleague could say something about the Wisconsin cryosphere in the age of global warming.
All right.
Yeah, very interesting. Stefan, good to hear from you. Stefan Hastenrath is an emeritus professor in our department, one of the world's experts in tropical meteorology. And he and I often talk about the catastrophe of ice forming on the big lakes here, how fast it happens. So he has an eye on the ice all the time. I think in the last, 160 years or something, Lake Mendota, the ice, the length of time the ice has been on has gone down by 18 days over that period of time on average.
Yeah.
And then there are years like this one, I think, will be an anomaly in the long sense.
But beyond the median.
Yeah, there's bounces up and down, but the long-term average has decreased by 18 days, which is about 20% of the average season. So the ice season has decreased by about 20% in the last 150 years here.
Wow.
That's 2 weeks. Yeah, less ice fishing.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Three if you're cautious.
Yeah. Well,
or not cautious.
Yeah, back in the days when I was a young guy and you know how the ice always melts right near the shore.
We
take a plank and put it out onto the ice and out on the plank to get out on the ice there for that last bit of fishing.
That gives walking the plank a whole new meaning.
Oh, my goodness. Stefan, thanks.
Well, don't forget, tomorrow we celebrate April Fool's Day. Mm-hmm. And I think our Wisconsin cryosphere does a very, very nice contribution.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I suppose you don't want to divulge that. April Fool's Day.
We're
fools enough.
Yeah, right.
There was. I was thinking back to my April Fool. When I was a young guy and I was looking, I was in league for in competition for a position, and I got a note from the secretary that I'd gotten a call from this company or from this organization. It was the Department of Ag, Trade and Consumer Protection, from Dr. Lyon, And I called several times and got a busy signal all day long. I kept trying. And I find out at the end of the day that it was the Vilas Park Zoo.
Oh, man.
And Dr. Lyon. I finally got through at 5:30 in the afternoon, and the guy at the zoo said, this is the zoo.
Oh, he said, all day long?
He said, we take the phone off the hook on New Year's on April Fool's Day, we take the phone off the hook because there's so many calls for Mr. Bear or Mr. Lion.
That's terrible.
Yeah. I was so mad at the secretary who did that, pulled that on me. Well, and I didn't get that job, so here I am. Emily in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Emily.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is regarding the use of tornado sirens or warning sirens.
Yeah.
I didn't know if there's like a statewide or even nationwide standard for when they should be triggered. I lived for most of my life under the assumption that they were only triggered for tornado warnings in your area. And then I moved to a city in northern Wisconsin, and the first time I heard the tornado siren, I wasn't aware of there actually being a tornado warning, and come to find out they triggered them for watches, for warnings. So I found it really confusing. And I didn't know if it was up to each city and town when they could be triggered, or if there was an actual standard or law in the state.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I would guess there's two things that possibly are going on. So let me just make a guess that there is a national standard, but that I think some of the criteria and decision-making in the process of alerting the public has probably changed. So maybe there was a change that was coincident with your moving to a new place. That's just a guess. I don't know. It certainly would be wise if it were sort of a national standard in those areas that face the threat of tornadoes. But I don't know the answer. Good question.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that it is a nationally regulated on who can do it and who cannot do it. And I'm pretty sure it has to be associated with the National Weather Service, maybe the National Severe Storm Labs set it off. I don't think they do it for watches. I think it's only done for warnings.
Yeah.
But we'll have to look into it. And it's done for a region. So, you know, it could be, the siren could be going off and it could look like there's no thunderstorms in your area, but in the locale for that section of the tornadoes, it may be...
Might be there. There might be something there.
Or it could be testing. I know down here they test them every first Wednesday of the month at noon.
First Wednesday, yeah. There's one right outside our studio.
It is possible that they might sound them for a thunderstorm warning in addition to tornado warning?
If they... That would seem sort of rogue to me.
Yeah.
I don't think so. But, you know, maybe somebody's got their finger on the button and they're doing that. I hope that's not the case.
Yeah,
but
I think it would be just for tornado warnings.
Yeah, I'd be suspicious if that were true.
Thanks, Emily. Thank you for calling. We have a severe weather spotters class is going to be held in Dane County on April 22nd.
They would know.
At the Alion Energy Center. So, well, we have a link on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show to some more information about that if you want to sign up for a severe weather spotter class, April 22nd in Dane County at the Alion Energy Center. Hey, boy, the time flew. John, Steve, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Larry.
We'll look forward to your visit at the end of April. Oh, my goodness.
Mayflower's on the way.
Mayflower's on the way. Oh, man. We thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.